Blog Talk Radio.
Tony Pennycal.
That was an interview between Jameel McCline interviewing Smokin' Joe Frazier back in July of this year. And Joe Frazier passed away on November 7th this week of liver cancer. And it was sort of sudden. We heard the announcement that he had it only a couple days before he passed. And tonight we're going to dedicate the entire show Joe Frazier, and obviously the boxing community's lost a huge ambassador, guy who will always be associated with Muhammad Ali and their three fights, and just a true hero to the boxing world. Guy that was very bitter towards Ali till recently for the comments that he made. In and outside the ring, of course. But he did forgive him finally. And we also are mourning the loss of another great boxing hero that's not as heralded, but was a great guy. The original Iron Mike Pusateri, I call him.
And, yeah, I mean, I got that notification last week. It was funny. I was leaving work. By the way, before I go on, I want to give a shout-out to a coworker of mine that's listening tonight. Kathy, I'm glad you finally tuned in after almost 2 years of me telling you about the show. Yeah, I was leaving work last Friday, and as I was getting into my car, I just opened up my phone and clicked on Facebook and noticed a posting on there from a page, The Life and I believe it's the Life and Redemption of Rocky Marciano. They're talking about some work they're doing on Marciano, working on a book. And it said, we are saddened to think of Terry, who passed away rather suddenly. And Rich, the first thing I could think of was like, oh shit, man, I got to get a hold of Rich, because I know you being up in that area and all the work you did with the Marciano family, the Marciano Foundation. We were supposed to have Mike on the show a couple times. We were unfortunately not able to connect with him, but. And then the very next day, about a month ago, me being part of the Philadelphia boxing fraternity, you get sometimes details, inside details, and a few weeks ago, a friend of mine, George Hansen, had posted something on his Facebook page saying like, get well, Joe Frazier, Joe's in the hospital. And, it's no secret that Joe had some health issues during the last few years, chronic back problems. He was walking with a cane. He was diabetic. Joe had some problems with his blood. Actually, the way I first got in close with the Frazier family was at a party where I met a friend of Joe's cardiologist, and this was back in 1996, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit more later. There was no secret that Joe was having some health issues. So, okay, Joe Frazier's in the hospital. Okay, he's a 67-year-old man. It's not, that uncommon. And then when the news broke on Saturday that he had advanced liver cancer, and it's like, oh, my God. And then, of course, all the rumors start flying. And I'm getting stuff from inside. He's trained with the Frazers and, close members of the Philadelphia boxing community. And then there was an article that came out on Sunday or Monday, I really don't remember, that they were considering taking him to Moscow for experimental treatment. I'm like, well, the man will never survive the trip from what I'm hearing. And then news broke Sunday night that he had passed, but that was a Twitter hoax. Things were popping up on Wikipedia and everything. Monday night, the Eagles were playing Monday Night Football, and I was watching it, and it was a back-and-forth game. And during the one commercial, you have a bad feeling about something. And I just went into the other room, and I punched on the computer, and that's when the news broke again. And, of course, from the previous night, it was a hoax. So you're sitting there and you're praying to yourself, maybe it's a hoax again. When you hear somebody that goes in hospice care, it's not a good sign. It's end of life. That's what it really means. It's a nice way of saying it like that. And, there are people talking about, donating part of their liver and possibly a new liver could, be formed out of that. And, they're talking about some really experimental things here. But you're also talking about guys in hospice care. It's like, would that even take effect after he was so ravaged? They said, he didn't want visitors outside of his family because he had lost, 50 pounds, and they said he was emaciated. It's kind of hard for me to collect my thoughts a little bit right now. Even Larry Holmes, who was a former sparring partner, Larry Holmes, former head of the this is only family members. And then the news broke again Monday night. And then this time it was immediately confirmed on ESPN and CNN. And I just sat in front of my computer, and I honestly felt so empty at that time. Oh, man, Joe Frazier, And his career was pretty much over before I was born. He only had one fight after I was born. And but from my dad. It was like my dad and my grandfather and my uncle. It was my dad that really taught me about Smoking Joe Frazier. He would tell me like when he was champion and everything. And, of course, the men in my family sided with Frazier over Ali, first of all, because of the Philadelphia connection. But also, my dad was an Army guy. My dad served in Korea during the Vietnam War. My grandfather served in World War II in France. My uncle. So these guys were all kind of anti-Ali for dodging the draft. So they all really forwarded and, you know, stood behind Frazier. So I was kind of taught that. And growing up, you know, I wanted to start getting into boxing when I was at 13 years old. And I really wanted to do it. But I didn't know where and I didn't know how. So my dad bought me a heavy bag, and I would just punch it every day. I mean, my form was terrible. And then he also bought me this videotape in 1990. It was called Heavyweight, The Big Punchers. And it was chronicling some of the greatest punchers in heavyweight boxing history. The Jack Dempseys, the Joe Louis's, the Rocky Marciano, Sonny Liston, all those guys. And Joe Frazier was on there. And he was the first guy they profile on there. And they were talking about, you know, his left hook. I mean, he basically fought his whole career one-handed almost. So they're talking about this Frazier left hook, and they kept calling it the Philadelphia left hook. And I'm like, well, I'm from Philadelphia. I have to throw a left hook now because it's a Philadelphia left hook. I have to throw it. And I would get outside and stand on that heavy bag and hit it for so many hours with my left hand that people thought I was left-handed. They would say, kid, you ought to be boxing southpaw if you're left-handed. I'm like, I'm not left-handed, but I wanted to throw a left hook like Joe Frazier. And the other night, I finally got my gym back open again. And so I finally got the mask back down, took all the Halloween decorations down. I'm like, all right, man, it's time for me to get back to business. And, you know, I warmed up and I taped my hands up. And I always do the first round as a warm-up round. I only use my left hand, jabs and hooks. And I always call that round the Joe Frazier round. And when I'm taping up and I'm like, all right, time for a round of Joe Frazier. And then I actually got really sad as I was about to start the workout. I was like, damn, man, Joe ain't with us no more.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, one of those characters that changed the sport. And, you know, as a heavyweight champion.
I mean, you get so many stories, like you can tell. And you figure, coming from a guy that only met him a handful of times and watched him train guys, that's the one reason I asked you to post that article I wrote in 2008, Joe Frazier versus Mike Tyson. And the reason I wanted it on there was because I figured he would beat Mike Tyson because of his heart. Mike was a guy, and some people thought, you know, he was bigger than Joe and he was faster, and Mike was a fast starter while Frazier was a slow starter, that maybe Mike would have just bombarded him early and knocked him out in a few rounds. But I don't see that happening. I could see Frazier going down about three or four times, and the down goes Frazier, you know, chance happening. But I could see him getting up, and I could see Mike with that look in his face, that oh shit look, and Joe just breaking his spirit and really breaking his body, and winning that probably around the 11th, 12th round. That's the reason I wanted that one posted on there, and I'll tell you. My favorite story, and I've been telling this a lot the last few days, and Rich, I know it's another old one to you, but I posted it on Facebook, and, you know, been telling some coworkers was the show I went to in 1994 down at the Philadelphia Convention Center, down and around Center City, Philadelphia. It was 4th of July weekend. They were doing a big Welcome America event. And it was about a 3 or 4 day event, and the one night they had a professional boxing card. You know, it was a non-televised card, but it was, you know, some good young local fighters. Some really good scrappy kids were going to be on that show. And, you know, I wanted to get into boxing. I was about to go to Lock Haven and start boxing there. So my dad was going to take me to the show. And so we were up there, and we're in the bleachers. And I said that my one regret is that I did not have – well, any camera on me, but especially then they didn't make them at the time, digital cameras. where, like, you can video anything now at any time and go right to YouTube. But, you know, 17 years ago, you didn't see that type of technology. And Joe Frazier was there, and Muhammad Ali was there. And Muhammad Ali was really suffering from Parkinson's at the time, and this was about 2 years before he lit the torch at the Olympics, where he was shaking very badly. And Joe got in the ring first, and, of course, you know, he's a Philadelphia guy, and he's a legend. And the people are just, you know, chanting like crazy for Joe Frazier. And then they're helping Ali into the ring. And, of course, the people are going nuts. And, you know, this is the legendary Muhammad Ali. It's like right there, literally feet away from me. Frazier and Ali are so close, I can almost touch them. And Ali, they help him in the ring. And he gets in the ring, and he's got his head down. And he picks up his head, and he sees Joe Frazier. And almost like you could see, his eyes sparkled. And he started, he got on his toes and started dancing. And he started doing the Ali shuffle. This was a guy that could barely walk up the steps. And Joe looked at him. And Joe bent down in that crouch and started bobbing and weaving. And it looked like it was Manila all over again. And it was quite possibly the most amazing thing I've ever seen. I mean, there were adults there that were crying. And, I mean, it was remarkable. I'll just put it that way. It was remarkable. And then a few months before that, that happened in July, around 4th of July weekend. Probably around March of that year, I got to meet Joe. And I was working at Roy Rogers at the time, and a 17-year-old high school kid. I'm going to go to Lock Haven the following year to start boxing, but I really had no training. I was just a glorified guy coming off the streets, really, that would just hit a heavy bag every day. But I thought I was good. I found out a few months later that I had a lot of work to do, but I didn't know. So I'm going to meet Joe Frazier, the guy that I emulated throwing that left hook so many times. And I was working that day. My dad shows up at Roy Rogers, and he's like, "Yo, Tony," he goes, "Joe Frazier's doing an autograph signing at a beer distributor in Northeast Philadelphia. Do you want to go?" I'm like, "Do I want to go? Hell yeah, I want to go." And I'm like, "Dad, I'm working. My shift's till 4 o'clock. He goes, "Oh, he's only signing until like 2. And I'm sitting there, I'm almost crying because it's a chance to meet Joe Frazier. And it was a friend of mine, from when I went to high school, it was only about a half mile from where this Roy's was. And we all used to hang out there on weekends and stuff. And the one kid that was a high school friend of mine, I've known him since grade school, and he was about 4 or 5 inches shorter than me and had to be a good, you know, 70 pounds lighter than I am. He was a skinny little guy. And he's like, "Tone," he's like, "give me your shirt and give me your hat. I'll work for you till you get back." I almost kissed him, you know? I mean, so I gave him my shirt, and this guy is swimming in his shirt. But it works for me. So my dad takes me out to see Joe Frazier, and I'm standing, you know, in the line with the other people. And Joe had, you know, a couple beers with him, and he's eating his sandwich. And he'd sign an autograph, shake a hand, take a photo, sit down, take a few bites, and take a few drinks. And I'm so excited, and I got my camera there, and I'm almost shaking. I'm so excited. So I get up there, and I had on a white ringside shirt. And I was like, "I'm going to get Joe and his son Marcus to sign the back of it. It's going to be so cool." So I go up to Joe Frazier, and he stands up. I shake his hand. I'm going to take a photo. And I'm like, "Will you sign my shirt, sir?" "Ah, sure, you know, whatever." So I kind of get in front of him and stoop down a little bit. He's like, "Son," I'm a naive 17-year-old kid. You know, I don't know no better. He's like, "Son, don't ever bend over in front of another man. You know what kind of man I am?" And, I mean, I was laughing. And he was funny about it. He was laughing about it. I mean, great picture. I mean, and I actually, the picture right now is my Facebook profile picture. And three genuine smiles in that photo, Joe, Marvis, and, of course, myself. I mean, I was cheesing ear to ear. I was so excited. And that was great. You know, I got the photo, and I was so happy. And a few months later, I'm off to Lock Haven, and then I started boxing, and everybody would always say, "Man, watch out for Penny Cal's left hook." And I'm like, "Yeah, because Joe Frazier." And then the last little one I'm going to tell you before I let you talk a little bit, as you can tell, this is a topic that means a lot to me. A couple years later, 1996, I had just completed my second year at Lock Haven. I was a regional runner-up. I lost to the eventual national champion in a real close fight at the regionals. So we're at a party for a friend of mine who had just graduated through basic training in the Marine Corps. So a bunch of us are there. We're having a pig roast. We're having a very good time. And my dad meets this guy who's friends with Joe Frazier's cardiologist, a guy by the name of Dr. Dupacci. And, I give him my name and my number. This is, when all you had was a landline to your house. I don't even know if I had caller ID back then. I don't think I did. And, you got to even have cell phones. So we give out this number, and a couple months pass, and I had to go in for a pretty serious knee surgery. I had been really having some problems for the previous 2 years to the point where the doctor said, if you want to continue as an athlete, we have to do some repairs in here. We have to clean this out and remove some of these calcium deposits on your kneecap, or you're done. So I go in there, I get scoped out, and since it was removal of bone off of bone, it was pretty painful, and they drugged me up pretty good for about 2 weeks. So the day I get released from the hospital, once again, right around 4th of July, I'm at home, sitting there, my leg is about 6 times its normal size, it's propped up, and I am doped out of my mind. And I'm laying there, and the phone rings. Now, the phone had been ringing constantly from friends and relatives, calling me, seeing if I'm home from the hospital, and how I was doing, and people come up to visit me. So the phone rings, and I kind of reach over and get it. No caller ID. And I said, hello. And I said, hey, can I talk to Tony? And I swear to God, it's my friend Dave. Hey, man, what's up? How you doing? Hey, Tony, this is Marvis Frazier. I want to talk to you about coming to train with us down at the Frazier Gym. I said, yeah, right, man. That's a good one. And I said, what happened? He goes, yeah, Tony, we got your name and your number through my father's cardiologist, Dr. Dupacci. You met a friend of his at a party a few months ago. I said, oh, shit. This is the real Marvis Frazier. I said, oh, sir. I said, listen, I'm sorry. I said, I thought it was a friend of mine pranking me. I said, I just came home to this morning from having major knee surgery done. I said, I'm sorry. I said, let me have you talk to my father. He's kind of helping me out right now. I said, but I want to let you know right now, I'm on the shelf for the next 8 weeks. And Marvis is very gracious. I thanked him for calling me. Then my dad took over, and they wanted to offer me like a full-time deal. They wanted me out of college. They wanted me boxing for them full-time. And Rich, you know about this crazy game. The chance of success is low. The chance of injuries and being permanently disabled, it's a realistic opportunity. It's a realistic danger you step when you're dealing with concussions and stuff like that. I'm like, well, before I do anything, I've got to finish my college education. Because say I went and started fighting with Joe and my knee completely blew out and I was done. Now I'm a kid with 2 years of college education with me. I'm not going to be able to get it. And then I'd have to go back to college and finish up. So we declined the offer graciously. And the other reason was I had the trainer that really worked with me for a long time. He took me and took me under his wing when I was nobody. And nobody wanted anything to do with me. He was the one that, saw that there was a diamond still buried deep inside this lump of coal, and he was really working on getting that diamond out. I was too loyal to leave him after doing that for me. So we did decline the Frazier offer, but I could still, say that I had an offer like that.
Alrighty then. Well, we're going to get Patrick McElligott on the phone. And shortly after that, we're going to have John Greenberg join us. But Patrick's a little older than us, so he'll probably have a little bit more memory of the great Joe Frazier.
Hello?
Hello, Patrick.
Yeah.
Hey, this is Rich. Rabble-rousing Rich.
How are you doing?
Pretty good. We also have Tony the Tornado on the line.
Hey, Tony.
Patrick, it's good to talk to you again. How are you doing, sir?
Good, good. How are you?
I'm doing all right. You know, a little bit of a somber week in the Philadelphia area and I guess the boxing world overall.
Yeah, yeah, very sad.
And, Patrick, we're going to have another guest on in a few minutes here, in about 5 minutes. So it gives you a little bit of a chance to tell us what you're all about and what you remember about Joe Frazier, since it's a tribute show tonight.
Well, I think the thing that stands out the most for me was when I was 15 years old, and my middle brother, I have two brothers, was 19, and he and I went down to New York City, and we had ringside seats to the second Frazier Ali fight. And it just, you know, was an enormous event for two kids from rural upstate New York to be sitting ringside. George Foreman was right near us. Teddy Kennedy was to my right. Emil Griffith was sitting with us, talking with us through the fight. And just Frazier was an intense man. I had a few other opportunities to be in his presence. And, of course, I know his son Marvis casually, but he's just a great fighter. And you certainly have to take into account his trilogy with Ali, but his career stood on its own as a great champion even without the Ali fights. That's what the article I put up, I tried to express, was this guy was just an intense fighter that earned everybody's respect and admiration even before Ali.
Right.
Absolutely. I don't think I could agree anymore with that. Very true statement. I mean, some of the things that he did, I mean, first of all, he represented the United States of America in the Olympics after Buster Mathis got hurt and Chen went there, and he, even with a broken hand, he brought home the gold medal, which back then, that really meant something in Olympic boxing. It's obviously not so much now. No disrespect to anybody that goes up there fighting the Olympics the way the scoring is anymore, and the lack of coverage Olympic boxing even gets. But he brought the gold medal home, you know, when it really meant something. And it was difficult for him because with Ali being banished from the sport for 3 years, no matter who succeeded him as the recognized champion of the world, there was going to be a question mark over that person's head, you know, because he, quote-unquote, did not beat the man who beat the man.
Right.
And that's why he lobbied, I think, so hard to get Ali reinstated. He was doing it as a favor to a person he considered a friend. And I know years later, Joe, who was, you know, bitter for a lot of years, came out and said, he goes, I think I finally realized why Ali said all the things that he said. Now, the first thing I would have thought was promotion, build up a fight. But then again, with those two, I don't think you need to really do a lot of promotion for two undefeated heavyweights with a legitimate claim to the heavyweight championship of the world. That's promotion enough. But I thought, okay, maybe Ali was just trying to promote it and being himself. But Joe had a different take. Joe was like, he was scared. Joe was like, because he did the same thing. He's like, he did the same things with Sonny Liston. He goes, that was his way of psyching himself up against the fear.
Absolutely. He did it with Liston. He did it to a large extent, but not as much with George Foreman. And
yeah.
he had to get himself, in old times the Irish called it berserking. You have to go into that different mental phase, and he worked himself into it. And it definitely is almost a tribute to Frazier, if people look at it correctly, that Ali had that much fear. The guy was a scary man to fight. Also, one of the things that I think is important and it's often overlooked is that 3 weeks after the fight in Manila, Muhammad and Joe went together to march for Reuben Hurricane Carter. So even with all the disagreement between them, they still had times when they got together for common cause, something they thought was important.
All right. Well, we got to add John Greenberg here to the call. He's an author who's written a little bit about boxing. We've had him on the show before.
Good evening, John Greenberg. Could I help you?
Hi, John. This is Rabble Rouse and Rich Bergeron.
How are you?
Great. We have a couple guests in addition to you on the phone tonight. We have Patrick McElligott. He's a boxing historian who writes for the site. And we also have our co-host, as always, Tony the Tornado. And we're doing a Joe Frazier tribute show tonight. So,
right.
Any memories?
He's well deserving of it.
Right. What stands out in your mind about Joe?
What stands out in my mind is, of course, the great rivalry with Muhammad Ali, and also the fact of how Muhammad Ali really used that to promote himself. And basically, Howard Cosell jumped onto Muhammad Ali's coattails, and this heavily promoted Howard Cosell. And Joe Frazier took the brunt of some real abuse during all those interviews, especially the one in January of 1974. And when Ali called him an Uncle Tom and called him a gorilla, that was just really, really over the edge. And I think it really showed that even though Joe Frazier became very enraged by that, I think it really showed that this man just wasn't really given the respect that he should have been given as far as being a heavyweight champion.
All right. Some of that stuff guys would get sued for saying these days.
Yeah. I mean, in today's world, can you imagine calling an African-American a gorilla? It just it wouldn't happen.
Right. No, only Ali could get away with that. You know,
right.
It's interesting to keep in mind also, if you go back to when Joe was going to fight Buster Mathis, you had a pretty large group with Harry Edwards, the professor from San Jose University, and many others saying to Joe beforehand and to Buster, we will not recognize you as champion if you win this fight. And we will make sure, and this is a pretty direct quote, we will make sure that there are not black kids coming up for your autograph. We will be sure that they are throwing stones from windows.
Yeah. Well, those were very turbulent times. Our nation was really divided, and that all gets back to that 1971 bout in Madison Square Garden. You know, I can't imagine ever seeing another fight like that as far as bringing in all these different celebrities. Frank Sinatra wanted to be at ringside so bad he agreed to be a photographer and reporter for some magazine. That was just unbelievable. But there was basically the establishment represented by Joe Frazier against Muhammad Ali, who was the radical left-wing lunatic fringe, the man who refused to serve his country.
And wasn't that fight where I think all the people like there, at least in the front rows, had to be either in a tuxedo or an evening dress? Or was that
absolutely?
Yeah.
Whether that was an enforced dress code or not, I'm not sure. But I was just peer pressure, because the women were dressed up like models off of a runway, and the men, well, you know, you couldn't get near the place unless you were among the elite. So it was just a huge event, just big entertainment, and the boxing was almost like a sideshow to the whole thing. But the boxing, it lived up to the billing. And I think that when people see that great three-fight rivalry, especially the last one, the Thrilla in Manila, Joe Frazier almost died in the ring that night.
Yeah. And
both men. You know, both men. Yeah, absolutely, because neither man was the same after that fight. And Muhammad Ali is still alive today, but now he's really, you can see the effects of that bout on him.
Okay. Sure.
And so I wonder...
Go ahead.
Yeah, I think Muhammad Ali really understands as far as Joe Frazier was the perfect straight man for him. And if it wasn't for the man that Joe Frazier was, it's possible that Ali wouldn't be the icon that he is today because of the way that Joe Frazier handled himself. And Joe Frazier came from a far more deprived background than Muhammad Ali did.
Sure. They're both one half of that rivalry. And,
right.
And they both brought out the best in each other. Even the Manila fight, neither was close to their prime, but they were still evenly matched, and it was such a brutal fight.
Right.
110 degrees in the ring before they started fighting.
Yeah.
The first fight, they were actually both better at a higher level of talent. And the second fight is largely overlooked, but it was a heck of a good fight. Ali made it kind of just an easy win by not standing and slugging with Joe. The third fight, he thought he was going to knock him out. He thought Joe was done and stood toe-to-toe with him quite a bit of it. And it left both of them different human beings afterwards, physically.
Well,
that conversation we had in the ring in Manila, I think Ali said to him in like the fourth or fifth round, he goes, "Smoking Joe, I thought you was finished." And Joe said, "They told you wrong, pretty boy."
Yep.
Well,
I am under the the agreement that Eddie Futch did the right thing that night in stopping the fight.
Sure.
The late great Eddie Futch, I still regard as possibly history's not just best trainer, but best gentleman. And I really know that he takes a lot of pride, wherever he is now, looking down on the job Freddie Roach is doing, because Freddie Roach was, a pupil of his. And the reason I always liked and respected Eddie Futch was his class, his knowledge, and his class, and his compassion. And it's a shame that a guy like Riddick Bowe got overshadowed, with a loudmouth like Rock Newman running his career when he had a great guy like Eddie Futch as his trainer. And Eddie did the right thing that night in stopping the fight,
Absolutely.
No one will ever forget what you did here. But if he would have let Frazier out for that 15th round just to get off the stool, do you think Ali would have not come off his stool?
I don't know about that. I think it's, Frazier, he had slits for eyes.
Yeah.
He was practically blind. I think he would have been a sitting duck, and I think it's very likely that that Frazier would have died in the ring that night.
Yeah, I agree. Eddie Futch did the absolute right thing. He could have possibly saved the man's life, he could have saved his life, and Joe would be mad at him for it.
Well,
yeah.
This is the competitive nature, but on the other hand, we're talking about Futch being a great human being because he loved his fighter and he loved the sport of boxing. And he was going to do the right thing, and he was man enough to do it and to do that call. And now today, not to change the subject, but we've got this absolutely horrendous situation at Penn State, which is caused by a coaching legend not doing the right thing when it should have been done. And this could destroy that whole program.
Absolutely.
Now Eddie Futch, if he had sent Joe Frazier in for the 15th round, it would have tarnished the sport of boxing to have a man die in the ring like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you can another example that comes to mind when you're saying Penn State is we all remember when Emil Griffith, the last fight with Benny Kid Perret. And Benny died a few days later. And what did his manager say when he was leaving and a reporter heard him? "Well, I guess I have to find another fighter." And there are many boxing owners of fighters, and that's the only way to say it,
right,
who really looked at them as cattle, as
throwaway people.
Yeah.
Throwaway disposable people.
And so the Eddie Futches stand out so much in contrast to that. And that I think the Frazier, stopping Frazier at that point is one of the highlights of boxing, of what a good man will do.
Yeah.
I remember a fight, obviously, when it was on a much, much smaller scale. It was a world title fight back in 1995. It was the fight between Gabriel Ruelas and Jimmy Garcia on the undercard of Oscar De La Hoya's knockout of Rafael Ruelas. And everybody knew going into that fight Jimmy Garcia was going to be outgunned and outmanned. And he had just lost his previous fight, so how he was getting another title fight was beyond me. But they get into that ring, and as expected, Gabriel Ruelas is dominating that fight, and he's battering Jimmy Garcia around the ring. Ruelas is winning every round. The fight is not competitive, and by the fifth round, it should have been a candidate to get stopped. And it was Garcia's own father and brother that were working his corner that night that after every round that he's coming back to the corner, they're slapping him in the face and telling him to fight harder. Well, it's obvious that, you know, he was, you know, completely outclassed. There comes a point when you have to be the compassionate one and say,
right,
this fight is over. The fight got stopped in the 11th round, and Garcia died a few days later, and in
right.
turn ended up ruining Gabriel Ruelas' career because he never recovered mentally from that. Almost like Boom Boom Mancini.
Even though it's played, even though it's a competition for money, it's still sport.
Mm-hmm.
And once it gets out of that realm, that's what's really bad, and that's what's really sickening about these situations is they forgot that this is a sport, you know, and they
right.
that it's not worth dying over because it's basically a game. You know?
Right, and there is a danger, I believe, and there are exceptions, but it's very dangerous to have a father or a blood relative making the calls in a corner. It's one thing for a relative to train a fighter, but to be there making the calls from the corner in you know, a heated contest,
right.
they lack the objectivity. And the fight you mentioned, one of my brothers actually was there that night, and that's a good example where just the horribly wrong call.
Right. It can get into a question of family honor, which is
yeah.
not what it is. You know, this is not a blood feud. This is a sport. This is an athletic event. But another thing about Joe Frazier, you know, that interview, that got enormous ratings for ABC. And ABC in the, I don't know if you guys remember, but in the late 1960s, ABC was the number three network. They were way behind in ratings to CBS and NBC. And this wide world of sports and this whole focus on sports for ABC television with this all this showbiz, this big press conference and everything else and the interview with Howard Cosell, this just shot the ratings up. And if it wasn't for Joe Frazier and Ali, it's likely that ABC wouldn't be the big dominant giant that it is now with ESPN and everything else. It basically has a lot to say about sports on all levels. And that,
yeah.
I really think, all started with that that pre-fight interview back in January of 74.
Yeah, they had also made big advances in the ratings for just specific dates when they had the WBA tournament with
right.
fighters to replace Ali. They set a lot of records then. But, yeah, Ali and Frazier, because the two of them together were much bigger than boxing. As you said, when they had the fight of the century, that was American politics. That was American
right.
culture.
It was a clear-cut choice. A clear-cut choice. You're on one side or you're on the other side. There was no neutral parties involved. It was,
right.
And I really don't think we're going to see that again in the sport of boxing at the heavyweight level. I just don't, because I think you get the feeding system young, deprived athletes at the bottom rung of society. They're going into other sports.
Yeah.
Well, we figure it like this. I mean, a lot of your great potential heavyweights right now are either becoming power forwards in basketball,
right,
or tight ends in football, because it's like the perfect body size and athleticism for that.
Right.
And it's like this. If you can break into the NFL or the NBA, you're
right,
guaranteed to be making no less than 6 figures a season. So
I'm more likely 7 figures now because of that new NFL contract. They've got a $122 million payroll salary cap for each team, 53
right,
players at $122 million.
Right.
You know, I mean, the numbers are there. And then also, that's another thing, too, about pay-per-view. Back in the 1970s, that meant that you had to get out of your house and go down to a hotel or go down to a movie theater or someplace and watch the fight. It wasn't something where you could do from the comfort of your living room. And a pay-per-view of boxing, I mean, it's just not there that much anymore.
I mean, you would see something like this right now is if Manny Pacquiao and Floyd Mayweather each bulked up about another 50 or so pounds, and that ain't going to happen.
No.
But, I mean, what you really need is you need a polarizing figure like another Ali to appear and somehow run roughshod over everybody, knocking out the Klitschko brothers, you know, beating the Eddie Chambers of the world and the Tony Thompsons of the world and those guys. And it doesn't hurt to be an American either. You got to be a polarizing figure. And then, and if you're playing the bad guy role and you have a lot of people adoring you, but a lot of people wanting to see you get whipped, that's not necessarily a bad thing because everybody will watch you even if they're split. You got half people watching you because they love you and half people watching you because they want to see you get knocked on your keister.
Well, that's the magic of Mike Tyson.
Exactly. To get your straight man, like a Joe Frazier, a hard-working blue-collar guy that can really resonate with, you know, the working-class people and, you know, the people that are conceived as underdogs, that, you know, they win more on heart and grit than they do on skill.
Right. And are more locked into traditional values and aren't as extreme in their lifestyle.
One of the reasons why it can't happen again is because whether a person agreed with him or not, Cassius Clay became Cassius X and then Muhammad Ali. He was closely associated with Malcolm X.
Elijah Muhammad,
FBI,
the Black,
You had the FBI tapping phone conversations between him and Martin Luther King Jr.
Right.
You had the Vietnam War, the war protests.
Right. I mean, the man was actually prosecuted, and it took a presidential pardon, basically, to get him back to be able to fight. Otherwise, he wouldn't have even gotten a boxing license. So.
Yeah. Well, he won the Supreme Court decision 8-0, and he was actually lucky because he was going to lose it 8-0 until two of the clerks for Justice Stevens had him read the autobiography of Malcolm X, and when he did, he showed it to the other seven who were involved in the case. One was sitting out, and then they decided, okay, this guy is sincere. And, you know, Ali came very, very close to losing that decision and facing 5 years in prison, which he was willing to do, but history would have been very different.
And I'm sure he must understand that, and I'm sure he's grateful for all of those narrow escapes that he's had in life, and all those fortunate occurrences along the way.
I don't want to take up a whole lot of time before we got both you gentlemen on the phone tonight, and I was doing my own tribute to Joe Frazier. I'm a Philadelphia guy, and so basically, even though Joe's career was basically over before I was born.
Right.
I was born September 76, about 11 months after Manila. Basically because my dad idolized Joe Frazier. I started to idolize Joe Frazier, and I used to think my dad bought me films before I even started boxing. And I would just practice left hooks.
because it was a Philadelphia left hook, and I felt the need to throw it. And I was telling Rich before
you know that left hook of his, that was the product of an unfortunate incident with a 300-pound hog when he was a little kid. He was running away from a hog, and he fell and injured his arm, and it never healed it with the full range of motion. So it was always sort of halfway cocked and ready for action at all times. But that just shows you his rough upbringing. I mean, he basically had to leave the South at the age of 15, you know, and go out on his own. And that's something that... You don't see even with kids today. I mean, kids today, no matter how bad their circumstances may be, I really don't think any of them were as bad as Joe Frazier's.
And wasn't he, like, married with, like, a child at, like, the age of, like, 17 or something?
That'd be about right, because that's when he hit Philadelphia. So he hit New York, and then he eventually got down into Philadelphia. But he really made a home in Philadelphia. And he made a great contribution to the community and to everything else. And,
yes,
and all his
love there.
You know,
right.
And he was 16
when Marvis was born.
You know.
For any of my fellow Philadelphians that are listening tonight, they did announce it today that Joe Frazier will be, you know, for any fans that want to pay respect this weekend, Friday and Saturday, he will be lying in state at the Philadelphia Wells Fargo Center. Unfortunately, the Spectrum was just demolished about a year ago. So, yeah, the Philadelphia Spectrum is no longer there, so that kind of sucks. But he will be at the Philadelphia Wells Fargo Center, and that's where fans can go. I believe it's like something like 10 to 5 tomorrow. So if I call out sick out of work tomorrow, you people know where I'm at.
Okay.
And then it's on Saturday, I think, 10 to 1. I'm not 100% sure.
It's a great tribute to the guy. And he was his workout was the one that Rocky Balboa emulated in that Rocky movie. You know, punching meat and running up the stairs and all that other stuff. He was Joe Frazier, he had a lot of influences on boxing that people really don't think about. They tend to think a little bit more of Muhammad Ali, but Ali was the consummate showman. So,
right. Well, I would say people who weren't there at the time or didn't see it, go to YouTube and watch the film of him with Jimmy Ellis or him in the first Jerry Corey fight. Those are Joe Frazier at his prime against very talented opposition, and he destroys them.
And those kind of like Jerry Corey, if he could put him in a time capsule and bring him out in his prime, the guy might do very well against the Klitschko's. So, you know,
there were many eras where Jerry Corey would have been champion.
Yep,
absolutely. Yeah, that was the one. I'll tell you, probably my favorite Joe Frazier fight in his prime was the one against Bob Foster. I mean, he was a guy that was just a destructive light heavyweight. But Bob did not have great success at heavyweight. But, I mean, Joe ran right through him like a bowling ball would through a wet towel.
That was an ugly fight. And obviously, I love Joe Frazier. I also thought the world of Bob Foster, and it made me sick to my stomach. I thought he was going to have his leg broken when Frazier drilled him to the canvas.
Wow.
Yeah. I was telling the other story tonight, and I'll do the very abbreviated version of it since I already told it to Rich, and I'm sure our fans don't want to hear the full story again.
Mm-hmm.
I met Joe for the first time in 1994 doing an autograph signing, and the picture right now is my main Facebook profile photo. I met him and Marvis, and Joe was having – he was at the autograph signing at a beer distributor. He was having a few beers with him, and he was laughing and smiling. And I was so excited that I was getting to meet Joe Frazier, the guy that I would stand in front of my heavy bag for hours and just slam left hook into the side of it. I'm going to meet Joe. And I went up to him. I'm like, "Sir, will you sign my ringside shirt on the back?" And I kind of stooped in front of him. And he said, "Son, don't ever bend over in front of another man. You don't know what kind of a man I am." And he laughed, and I laughed, and Marvis laughed. And we took a photo, and we're all smiling. And I have that T-shirt. I still have it. It's down in my basement gym. And it's signed. And actually, I took a picture of that the other night, too, and I never really noticed it until the other night when I took the photo. But right above the shirt is an artist-drawn photo of the Thriller in Manila.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And I have those together down there. And then a few months after that, I went to a fight card in Philadelphia 4th of July weekend. And it was a Welcome America. They were doing a lot of events, you know, to capitalize, you know, with Philadelphia, you know, obviously, you know, being the first capital of the country and all that good stuff. And there was fireworks and all that. So they had a fight card down there, and Joe was there, and Ali was there.
Huh.
And and I said, I wish the technology of today would have been available in 1994.
Cell phone camera.
Yeah, I would have been there with my digital camera, and I would have got this on video. And to my knowledge, no video exists of it.
No.
But Joe got in the ring first, and of course, he's in Philadelphia. He's a legend, and the fans are going nuts, and they're cheering for him. And then Ali was assisted into the ring because the Parkinson was really starting to slow him down. This was only 2 years before his where he was shaking badly at the Olympics.
Right.
So they helped Ali into the ring. Two guys did. He stepped through the ropes with his head down, and he looked up in the opposing corner, and he saw Joe Frazier, and the eyes lit up. And Ali, and I swear to God, got on his toes and started dancing and doing the Ali shuffle, and Joe bent down and had famous crouch of his and started bobbing and weaving, and they looked like they were going at it, and the crowd went ballistic, and it looked like it was Manila all over again. And, I mean, I was telling Rich earlier, there were adults in the audience with tears coming out of their eyes.
Well,
yeah.
If you're blessed to have been there, but, you know, like you said, if they had the technology we have now, you'd have it forever. But you're still great. It's fantastic that you were able to be there, because this is a man that had such a profound impact on your entire life.
That's what so many people of my generation that I've talked to in the last few days are saying, you know, not only loving Joe as a fighter and the thrill of watching him compete, but just he was such a man of respect. Everybody looked up to him. He was a wonderful role model.
Right.
And a lot of athletes are put in a position they don't want to be and they really shouldn't be. Joe Frazier was a perfect role model for a generation in America.
Right.
Thankfully, I think he left boxing at the right time, too, so he didn't have too much trouble speaking to people and everything like that. Even we played an interview at the beginning of the show, one of his last interviews in July. And, you know, some words were a little bit hard to recognize, but for the most part, you know, you could understand every word he said. So that's huge. So actually, there was a story the other day about one of the Klitschko brothers, I think it was Vitaly, is now showing signs of having Parkinson's, and he's still...
Oh, boy.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I really enjoyed being part of this discussion tonight, and unfortunately, I gotta run a little bit. I got another... They're waving at me right now. I gotta do something.
That's all right.
Okay.
Well,
thank you. Thank you so much for having me, and I always enjoy being with you guys.
All right. Thank you.
Nice talking to you.
Discussion.
Thank you.
Busy guy, John.
Hey, it's okay. Being busy is a good thing. Keeps you out of trouble.
Yeah. You've got a good publicist.
But, Rich, you know, obviously, you know, Joe Frazier is, you know, obviously overshadowing, you know, a lot of things. And like I said, me being a Pennsylvania guy, Philadelphia guy, going to Lock Haven University, which is only 30-some minutes away from Penn State, everybody, you know, assumes, oh, my God, I'm devastated about the whole thing at Penn State, which I'm not. I'm not a Penn State fan. I've had a grudge going on with them for the past 15 or so years, highlighted by your good friend Jesse Bond. A friend of mine emailed me last night, and he goes, we lost two Joes this week under different circumstances. And I want to look at him and say, hey, I only lost one Joe. The other one I was not a fan of. But we didn't spend a whole lot of time on our show, and I want to turn the forum over to you a little bit to talk about a gentleman from your neck of the woods that we also recently lost. We mentioned him at the beginning of the show. The original Iron Mike, Mike Pusateri, who was mentored by Rocky Marciano.
So let me turn it over to you, Rich, and we can do you a little bit of a tribute.
Well, Mike was such a good guy. I mean, always smiling, always looked like he was ready to go out to a formal dinner or something. You know, he loved wearing a suit, loved, you know, slicking his hair back, and just was a magnet, you know. People in Brockton, you know, always recognized him, all the old folks that followed his career. Didn't have a spectacular career. He went 30-24 with 28 knockouts, but he started off really well in the local area, all around Massachusetts and Providence. And he was trained by the same guy that Rocky Marciano was trained by, Allie Colombo. So he had a lot of experience growing up with the in the same generation as Rocky. And he fought all over the world. You know, he went to Denmark, South Africa, and one of the best memories I have of Mike is being in Joe Angelo's cafe at the bar area. And that place is probably only second to George's cafe in Brockton, where there's Rocky memorabilia everywhere you look. Every square inch of the wall is covered by a picture of some boxer or Rocky and Allie in training. And it's just, you know, Brockton, Massachusetts, of course, is also the home of where Marvin Hagler came up from. So it's a big boxing town, and the Petronelli brothers, we lost Pat Petronelli a few months ago. Goody Petronelli still is going strong at his gym. One of my best memories of Mike was we're in Joe Angelo's, and he's showing me all the pictures on the wall in one corner where he's in them. And there was one with him on the beach in South Africa, and he started talking about all the girls that were running up to him and how great it was to be recognized and to be able to, you know, go on these trips, you know, win or lose in his fights. It didn't matter. He was just having this experience. And he actually did have a heart attack while I was living in the area, and they had a stent put in. But I specifically remember before that happened, before he had the heart attack, he was telling me, you know, this guy's like in his 60s, talking about how he just ran 5 miles the night before. And he said, you know, it was so cold, he felt the tingling in his toes. And, you know, after the fact, when he had the heart attack, I was like, oh, geez, probably something to do with the circulation from the heart issue. And I haven't found out exactly what happened this time around, but I would assume it's probably something related to that. He was just an unbelievable guy. Never got out of shape. You know, always looked good. And you know, he drank a little bit, but that was about it.
What's wrong with that?
Yeah, I think he's.
Yeah, he's got to have some wine, right?
Yeah. But he was just a great guy, and always smiling. And you know, every time he saw me, he'd be like, "Hey, Richie," you know, big grin on his face. And you know, we tried to get him on the show a couple times, but it was always past his bedtime.
Yeah,
bed early at night. But great guy.
Yeah, we're gonna. Like I said, I never had a chance to talk to him. You know, look forward, you know, hopefully getting him on the air. I know a couple times we tried to do that. We were unsuccessful. But, you know, just from, you know, the stories you told me about him, and it was like, and of course, you know, being mentored by the great, late, great Rocky Marciano, which, of course, you know, I would have had some, you know, great conversations with that. That's one of my favorite stories. And we would have had a good laugh, and you know, may he rest in peace, Iron Mike.
Yeah, right. I always call him the original Iron Mike too. He was a middleweight, so wasn't as popular as Tyson, of course. But there probably was an Iron Mike before him, but he called himself Iron Mike. And a couple times when I was at some functions, I got to do some announcing. And I always called him the original Iron Mike when I introduced him in the audience.
and you know what the thing is, like, I didn't know the guy, I never met the guy, but I can imagine him just beaming when you said that.
Yeah, great guy. Never looked like he was a boxer either, you know. He didn't look beat up at all. Didn't have the flat nose or anything like that. But he was always at every function, too, that had anything to do with boxing. He was there.
Yeah, along the same lines, I guess I last saw Joe Frazier maybe about 2 or 3 years ago. It was at the National Guard Armory. It's where I went to my last fight, the show Brittany Rogers put on for her band promotions. And, you know, I was down there, and they had kind of the one area kind of like they had, like, guardrails. It was like a VIP area, which I was very un-VIP-ish that night. And, you know, Joe was there. He walked in with his cane, and, you know, we were there, you know, smiling, and people were coming up to him. And I guess this was probably about maybe 07, 08, because I'm pretty sure it was one of the cards that I covered for Fight News Unlimited. So it was within the last few years. I mean, I would like to see what they're going to do at the next Philadelphia Boxing Show. I know there's a show going to be on January 13th at the National Guard Armory that's being put on by Power Productions. I really try to, you know, avoid their shows as much as I can because the quality is never that great. You don't get your money's worth. But one girl, Brittany Rogers, that did the show on the end of September. She's doing a show at the formerly Alhambra, now I think it's called the Asylum down in South Philly. That's going to be on Friday, February 3rd. So once again, I might have to skip out of work that day to go to the Wing Bowl down in Philadelphia and watch people eat chicken wings, and then shuttle over to the fight. That'll be a fun day. but yeah, I'd like to get onto that one. And I know, you know, Brittany Rogers, who was for 22 years old, a boxing historian, was writing stuff on her Facebook page, and her and I were having, you know, some emails going back and forth and some conversations. And a 22-year-old girl who, you know, you figure only came into this world 10 years after Joe Frazier's last fight almost. She was, you know, very distraught, very broken up, and really wrote some glowing tributes about him. I mean, basically, there isn't really much to say except for the fact that, you know, they said Rocky Balboa was kind of inspired off of Chuck Wepner, who was like the no-hoper. When he fought Muhammad Ali and he almost went the distance,
right.
That was the inspiration. But as we was said earlier on the show with Patrick and John, look at some of the contributions that were incorporated into the original Rocky movie. Joe Frazier, the guy that worked in the slaughterhouse, who used to punch the sides of beef, that was stolen for Rocky. And let's not forget something in the original Rocky. Who was Apollo Creed ducking? He was ducking Joe Frazier. Joe was in the ring saying, come on, you've been ducking me long enough. He's like, no, Joe, you next. You next. Apollo Creed ducks Joe Frazier, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I've never watched any of the Rocky movies, but I do understand that a good bit of it came from Frazier. I think one of the important other things is on TV or in the newspapers, different people say, he didn't get the respect he deserved. He did among boxing community, not among boxing writers, not among journalists, but among the boxing community, and especially fighters. They knew this guy is just the toughest SOB around. I don't know anyone, and I've known a lot of people in boxing over the years, I don't know anyone who just didn't have great respect for Joe Frazier.
Absolutely.
I also think about, I'm not saying that the quality or the talent of the fighters was the same, but last weekend we had the Kirkland Angulo fight. That was a Joe Frazier feeling to that fight of just, you know, punching each other and getting up and fighting. That's the kind of fight you got with Joe Frazier. And we'll never have another Frazier.
but there are people that carry on that same spirit in the ring. And he was an inspiration to a lot of fighters.
I was thinking about it over the weekend when the news first broke that Joe was in very bad shape. I said I watched boxing when I was a little kid with my dad, and that's when they had like you would have to be switching the channels from ABC to CBS on Saturday afternoons because it was boxing on every channel, and you had some really good guys on there. You had the guys like, and you had some of your good middleweight and lightweight fighters like your Bazooka Ramones and your Boom Boom Mancinis. Sugar Ray Leonard was still fighting at the time. Marvin Hagler was still on the time. I mean, you had good, good fighters.
Right.
And I just remember watching these fights, with my dad, and some of the guys that I ended up really gravitating to. And I look at it now. I mean, there were certain guys, like the one guy I gravitated to, which is almost like he was the antithesis of everybody else, was Sugar Ray Leonard. Because Sugar Ray Leonard,
right.
I mean, Sugar Ray had heart. If you don't believe so, we'll go back to that first Tommy Hearns fight. But Sugar Ray was a good boxer. He was fast. He was charismatic. And I liked him for that. But the other fighters that I kind of grew up being a fan of, even though some of them were before my time, Joe Frazier, because that was kind of what my dad, would always talk to me about Joe Frazier. Rocky Marciano, because my grandfather and my great uncle would always tell me about Rocky Marciano. Then I kind of got away from boxing for about two or so years, and then Mike Tyson came around, and I was like, kind of watching it because it was like almost like watching like a car wreck sometimes, and you didn't want to see it, but you had to see it. And it was Mike Tyson and Vinny Mazienza both around the same time that I really gravitated to. And then a few years later, when I really started getting into boxing, and my dad was taking me down to my first Atlantic City pay-per-view card, and it was Michael Moore versus Burt Cooper, which ended up being the fight of the year that year, 1992. And I'm sitting there with my dad, and we're up in the balcony seats, the cheaper seats, and it was the second fight of the night. And I'm sitting there, I'm a 15-year-old kid, and the song Thunderstruck by AC/DC comes over the airwaves. And I'm like, yeah, AC/DC, yeah, I'm bobbing and dancing. And this skinny little Italian kid with bushy hair comes out. And I'm like, that's going to be my new favorite fighter, Arturo Gatti. He was 5-0 at the time. But I always gravitated to the guys that were more will than skill. And maybe that's because I'm a Philadelphia guy and, everybody else says we're a blue-collar town and we're more, gritty than skilled town. I mean, you can believe that if you want, but it was Joe Frazier, Marciano, Pazienza, Gotti, all these guys that, I really gravitated to. Some of them were Italian, what a surprise. But these were all of you just gritty, tough. The guys that were the underdogs that, just kind of won more on heart than on skill. That's the way I had my career, because I wasn't the most skilled guy. I wasn't the fastest, the biggest, the strongest. I was a guy that I would be willing to draw a line and say, I'll stand here, you got to make me back up.
Mm-hmm. Well, different places in Philadelphia is obviously such a great example of it, but different cities have their own flavor. Back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, even in amateur boxing, you had New York City and Chicago. Now we think a lot of, let's say, Los Angeles in that area with the Mexican-American fighters. And Philadelphia always has fascinated me. I've had the opportunity to meet quite a few of the guys from there. Guys like Eugene Cyclone Hart didn't win the title, but, boy, he made the division exciting. And Frazier is the best from Philadelphia, reached the highest peak. And he stood out. Years ago, we had fighter Paul Simonetti, who lived at our house for a while he was working construction. I believe he was from outside Scranton. And he fought on the undercard of the first Frazier Ali, the fight of the century. And just to hear him tell stories, he had been a sparring partner with guys like Bonavina and Jerry Quarry. And that was a golden age. That was a golden age of boxing. And Frazier was at the peak.
there were a lot of very tough men fighting there, and Joe Frazier went through them.
Yeah, there's an ESPN article that came out in the wake of his death that talks about how he actually was, as recently as September, still signing autographs, and he was at the Mayweather Jr. versus Ortiz fight here in Vegas. And signing autographs, and to everybody that came up to him, he would say, "Joe Frazier, sharp as a razor, what's your name?" So he's always...
I know Jameel McClain did a nice interview with him. I'm not sure if it's the last that he did, but it's very, very good. And I know Jameel feels really good about that opportunity.
Yeah, we played that at the beginning of the show, actually.
Oh, good.
Yeah. And it's kind of interesting, too. The same article says that when he fought for the title, he was only 205 pounds when he fought Ellis. And it kind of reminds me of the Rocky Marciano situation, because Rocky was even weighed even less. You know, there was an age before Joe, but... you know, you don't see that too often these days, guys around. That's actually the light heavyweight division in mixed martial arts, 205.
Yeah.
So that's remarkable, too.
It's funny to me to hear people saying, oh, Joe was a small heavyweight. I told a story on my tribute on Unlimited Fight News about when my brother was fighting in Utica. And my brother-in-law and I had trained my brother. My brother-in-law was almost the exact same size as Frazier. Just, you could have mistaken the two for each other. They looked very similar. And when Joe came around the corner in the dressing room, he just locked his eyes on my brother-in-law. And it was, I believe, 3.5 months after his second fight with Foreman. So he was officially a retired, but the competitiveness and just, he was quiet and just glaring, trying to figure out who my brother-in-law was. And you realize, oh, that's a scary man. After Bobic fought, he TKO'd Wepner that night in Utica. Later in the evening, Joe was a very jovial, friendly guy, fun to be around. But for those few moments, you know, that man was intimidating.
Yeah, for sure. We also probably should discuss a little bit about the upcoming fight this weekend. There will probably be some tributes going on there at the Manny Pacquiao versus Juan Manuel Marquez fight. And Tony did a big preview for it on the website, so if you guys want to check that out, if people listening, go look at that and see his analysis. But we should give it a little bit of time here and... talk about how we think it's going to go.
Rich, let me just do a quick rundown real quick, because, like I said, we spent the majority tonight on a you know, topic very important to me, and I'm sure to most of the boxing community out there. Last week, as we discussed a few minutes ago, we had a great fight between James Kirkland and Alfredo Angulo. I thought Angulo's chin would win out, but Kirkland really impressed me. He got dropped about 30 seconds into it, and he got up, and didn't look like he was going to last much longer, and Angulo punched himself out, and then Kirkland punched him out and stopped him in 6 rounds. That was a very good fight. On Showtime, we had Lucien Bute with a rather convincing decision over Glenn Johnson. Once again, it was a fight that I figured Johnson was just going to be a hair too slow, and you know, Bute just, you know, too young, too skilled. But we had some good championship boxing, good quality fights last week. I joked around with the Kirkland-Angulo fight, and my dad was away. He was just getting home from Connecticut. And I said, "Dad," I said, "the first round was so good that Marvin Hagler and Tommy Hearns could watch it and say, 'Damn, that was a good first round.'" But going into this weekend, we got the big Manny Pacquiao, Juan Manuel Marquez fight. Going to be on pay-per-view. And almost fitting, and I wrote my preview this week, and I'd like to, you know, just summarize my introduction to the fight card for the fight preview, where I came out and said, trilogies are a special thing in boxing. And trilogies, especially, sometimes you will get rematches. Rematches happen frequently.
trilogies happen because something special happened in there. And the fights were close. They were competitive. Sometimes you have fight of the year candidates in there. Sometimes they were the fight of the century. And I said, trilogies are a special thing in boxing. I said, you know, Pacquiao has literally exploded. You know, since he fought Marquez and knocked him down three times in 2004, Marquez clawed his way back for a draw. Then they fought again in 08, and Pacquiao had a knockdown that enabled him to win by one single point. And if you tally up all the cards over those 24 rounds that they fought, they are separated by one point. One point. But now the thing is, Pacquiao has gotten bigger. He's gotten better. Marquez, who for years was a very skilled boxer, he's now standing in front a little bit more. He's sitting down in his punches a little bit more, and he's punching harder. But the thing is, his legs look a little bit, they don't look really as strong as they used to be. He suffered a knockdown against Casillas. He looked hurt. He suffered a knockdown against Mayweather. He's not carrying the heavier weight as well as Pacquiao is, which I think will be the downfall. But the one thing I mentioned in my preview, I said it's almost a sad and ironic note that this trilogy is happening 5 days after the passing of Joe Frazier, who was in one of boxing's greatest trilogies. The final and maybe most famous fight, the Thriller in Manila, happened in the very birthland of one of the combatants from this weekend.
Yeah, beautiful. You're right. Very well said.
I
agree. I think Pacquiao is just too much at this point in his career. Marquez's legs are gone. The only two things that make me think he might have a chance, at least for a while, is the guy is a technician, unlike any other in this era. Probably is good to rate up with almost an Ezra Charles-like level of ability and technical skills. And also, Will, the guy is obviously driven to fight Pacquiao again. But I think he's going to probably get beat up. I think Pacquiao's too big, too strong, too fast.
Do you think it'll go the distance, or do you think it'll be a stoppage?
I don't think it'll go the distance. I just think that Marquez is vulnerable early against people, and I think Pacquiao at this point is a very capable at finishing somebody. You get hurt with him. The first punch he lands on you when you're hurt might not be the one to take you out, but the second or third will. He definitely has improved his ability to put consecutively harder punches together every combination, and his hand speed is amazing. And I think that he probably is going to stop him by the end of the sixth round.
I have it going a little bit longer. I think in like the first few rounds, you know, Marquez is going to try to use what's left of his legs. He's going to try to, you know, use some angles and to be that kryptonite to take down the superhuman Pacquiao.
Mm-hmm.
His style has always caused him problems. So I think, you know, I think he's going to try to keep the distance the first few rounds, keep him off balance, land some counters. By the end of the third round, I think Pacquiao is going to land a good combination and buckle him. And I think that's going to be the beginning of the end right there. I think I see Pacquiao scoring a knockdown maybe around the fourth or the fifth. With I think it's going to be one of those ones, boom, boom, where he goes down to the seat of his pants, kind of gets up around 4 or 5, maybe wobble a little bit, survives the round. But then I can see it getting increasingly worse. Marquez has been showing, the one thing I said in my article was, it seems like anymore that he's starting to bleed during the pre-fight instructions. I said, those sharp punches from Pacquiao, they're going to cause some abrasions, they're going to cause some swelling, going to cause some bleeding, and I could see that hampering his vision, that right around the seventh round, I think Tony Weeks is going to start looking in the corner, bringing the doctor in, you know, because Marquez is Marquez, he's, a Hall of Fame caliber fighter, he's a pound-for-pound caliber fighter, but they're going to let him go out on the shield. Pacquiao really be in control by the 7th, 8th round. 9th round, we'll take another look. And in the 10th, I mean, as soon as Pacquiao lands 2 or 3 punches,
Weeks is going to jump in and stop it. I think it's going to be like the first inning of the 10th round that it'll get stopped.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. One thing that I always keep in mind, Marquez is the only person in a long time who has hurt Pacquiao. And I don't mean, you know, hit him hard, but hurt him. And that's because he is a technician. He times people. And, he does have the ability. And sometimes an old guy like that, if they're mentally up for a fight, surprise everybody. Never know what's going to happen.
That's why boxing is a great sport.
Of all the people that Pacquiao's faced recently, I think Marquez will be the greatest threat. Because, number one, there's been sort of rumors circulating, I guess. I don't know. Obviously, we don't know if they're true, and I don't want to get sued like Mayweather there. But there's been talk that he's been doing steroids, you know. So whether that's true or not, just the fact that there's rumors going around makes you think that, you know, he's pulling out all the stops for this fight. He knows how important this fight is. And he's going to go in there with a different mindset than any other fight. And at the same time, you also have a situation where, you know, Pacquiao might even be looking past him because of all the talk about the Floyd Mayweather matchup. And there's actually a casino out here, Station Casinos, the same people that own the UFC. They've already set up a line on the fight, the Pacquiao Mayweather fight. And they said the rules are it has to happen by December of 2012. So it seems to me like, you know, as soon as this fight is over, as long as Pacquiao wins, then they're going to make that fight next. But I actually kind of think that that Marquez might have a chance to go the distance in this fight. I don't think he will, but I think there's definitely a chance.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he fought on even terms for 24 rounds.
Yeah, and especially if he were trying to, he could do that, you know, but he's going to try to win. Another thing I think of is Freddie Roach, when he studies an opponent, he doesn't look for the stupid mistake a person makes every so often. He looks for your habits, and Marquez does not have bad habits in the ring, you know. He's just a very efficient fighter. There's not a lot for the average guy to say, okay, this is how I'm going to beat Marquez. You have to be a great fighter to compete with him.
And but we know
they know each other.
We know he has some unorthodox training methods, too, with the hyperbaric chamber and the drinking his own urine. So who knows what he's going to do to get ready for this fight. So it's definitely, I think it's going to be worth watching.
I think it has a good undercard, too.
Pacquiao always amazes me with his ability to, you know, do the 1-2 punch constantly to the point where it's like he's not even blocking his face, but he's got such a good chin it doesn't seem to matter. And I think Marquez has an even better chin, so that's why I say I think it might go the distance.
I don't think anything would surprise me in this fight because they both are so capable, you know, in so many ways. Let's hope that it's not, you know, an accidental headbutt that causes a cut or anything like that. Good, clean fight. You know, may the best man win.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I definitely think boxing needs something to put the last Mayweather fight to rest. You know, that controversy with that just kind of ruined everything for a lot of people that were tuned in.
Floyd gets under people's skin, and similar to Ali, obviously in his own unique way, and you got to give the devil his due, he knows how to irritate Pacquiao's people a week or two before any of Manny's fights, you know, by making some announcement, something to distract. Muhammad used to do similar things to try to upstage people, to try to get them, you know, to break concentration. If Manny wins and they do fight on May 5th, which I believe they're going to in Vegas, it is going to be very good for the sports world.
Yeah, I think it's almost unavoidable. Pacquiao went on the Jimmy Kimmel show and said he's ready, so that's an indicator. into the lawsuit that he has ongoing. Floyd Mayweather hasn't even shown up for a single hearing, last I read. So he's kind of, I think, hoping that whenever they sign this fight, he can settle that along with it.
Yeah.
So I think that's how it's going to go. And Manny's going to be on Piers Morgan tomorrow night on CNN.
Mm-hmm.
He might say something there with all that time that he usually takes to go through his interviewees and all their tough questions. I'm sure that will be asked. But I don't know. I look at Mayweather, and he looks as good as ever, but he's changed. I think his fighting style's changed a lot in the last couple of years.
Oh, absolutely.
He's kind of avoided the shoulder roll technique that he used to do all the time, and he's gotten more aggressive. So I think it's the best time ever for this fight. And I really
I agree with that. With Ortiz, you saw Floyd doing something in preparation for Pacquiao where he would throw his right and then jump in, ducking. And he's definitely had Manny in mind when he's trying out new things in the ring. And so I think that he's bided his time. I think it's going to be the classic fight of this era.
It should be. For sure. And how about the undercard? I'm not looking at BoxRec right now, but probably should bring it up.
Does it have Bradley versus Casamayor? Is that one of the fights?
That is one of the fights. Boy, I mean, you want to talk about a fight where there's going to be some headbutts? Woo! Wow, it's going to be like two bucking Broncos in there. Because Casamayor is a southpaw known for leading with his head. Timothy Bradley, you know, he's got three fists. He's like a left, a right, and a forehead.
Yeah, he's got it down.
We got to have an over-under on this one. How many headbutts, how many cuts, any point deductions, will there be a disqualification? But in all seriousness, Casamayor is on the downside of his career. Mark, and he's moving up in weight. This should be a fight that Bradley wins, and wins convincingly if everything stays clean with, you know, without any headbutts, without any, you know, because Casamayor has never been the clean. He's a headbutt machine, but Casamayor, he'll low blow you, elbow you, you know, you name it, he'll do it.
Casamayor has a much larger run of dirty tactics. Just a master at everything. And any time an older fighter moves to fight a young guy who's coming into his, they're usually going to get beat. But, you know, as always, you don't know what will happen. You have two kind of unique styles against each other. It's not a given that Bradley will win, but I would certainly favor him. It is a fight that could get out of control very easily. I hope they have a very good referee for that fight.
Sure it is. Not just a very good referee, they might need a very big referee. You know, 240-pounders, you know. You might need a guy that's, well, you figure Tony Weeks is doing the main event. I'm going to see if I can find out who is reffing this one, because he's going to have his handful.
Yeah.
There's also a couple other good fights worth mentioning here. I got BoxRec up. We got a super featherweight 10-rounder between Luis Cruz, who's 19-0 with 15 knockouts, and Juan Carlos Burgos, who's 27-1 with 19 knockouts. That's for the WBO NABO super featherweight title. And then there's a new title, I guess. Never heard of this one. The IBF Latino light welterweight title going on. It's also a 10-rounder. between Mike Alvarado, who's 31-0 with 22 knockouts, and Bradus Prescott, who's 24-3 with 19 knockouts. I think he's the one that beat Amir Khan, right?
Yes, he is.
Like, what, like 40 seconds or something?
Yeah.
Which probably isn't going to happen again.
And you never know which Prescott is going to show up, the guy who's ready to fight or a guy who just doesn't seem to have his mind in it. That should be an interesting fight. But both of those fights that you just mentioned sound very good to me.
They really, if you're going to look at it overall, it looks like they did a very good job putting this card together. I mean, just looking at it from top to bottom, you got some definite quality fights out there.
Yeah, and that's important. When you ask people to pay for a pay-per-view fight, you need to have more than just a good main event. You need to have a solid undercard with two or three very competitive, high-quality fights. That's one of the areas where boxing is hurt compared to, let's say, MMA, is that boxing cards have too frequently been weak, with one good fight and a lot of fights that people shouldn't pay big money to see.
I got good news and bad news regarding the Timothy Bradley fight. The good news is the official is big. The official is about 6'4". The bad news is that official is Vic Draculich. He is an official that I remember Ring Magazine ranking the top 10 worst officials, and he was officiating, awful officiating.
Mm-hmm.
But at least it's not Lawrence Cole, who I think is the all-time worst referee. But Draculich, and I've had to just to give you a actor man in the ring on some of my amateur fights. And it was a fight out back in 1998 that I hit the guy so hard with the left hook. Well, props to Joe Frazier. I got hurt so hard with a left hook, the guy buckled. Vic Draculich went in, thought he was going to give him an A count, let him clear his head, and then waved us back on.
Nice.
So, yeah, not one of my favorite cases in there.
But certainly the lack of good officiating has also harmed boxing, and let's say even the last half of a year, there have been some very disturbing things, whether judging or particular referees.
I mean, you get that that Joseph Abeco, Baines Metro, Abner Mares versus Joseph Abeco. Russell Moore did a horrible job. I mean, that was a mandated rematch right there. So that's going to happen in a few weeks. That was atrocious. I mean, you have some fights with the judging. It's like, well, this fight looks like it's a pretty wide decision, but we are in Las Vegas or we are in wherever. Or, you know, so you're just telling you right there, it's going to be a bad decision. We had to deal with Floyd Mayweather and Victor Ortiz, where Joe Cortez, I mean, did he need to hit him like that? No. Mayweather was starting to take control of that fight. Did Ortiz need to hug him, kiss him, shake his hand, and hug him again? No. You tap the guy's glove, you say you're sorry, you're not going to do it again. The only reason you're tapping his glove is because you got caught. If you didn't get caught, what are you talking about? I didn't headbutt him. My name's Timothy Bradley. I'm not headbutting.
Right.
So,
I'll respectfully disagree on one point. I think Floyd not only didn't break a rule, I felt he was justified because protecting yourself at all times doesn't only apply to Ortiz, who should have been protecting himself. When you have a guy who is clearly out of control, who has just butted you where he's opened two big cuts, you have to protect yourself. I was okay with what he did. Would I rather that he didn't? Probably, but I don't blame him for that.
You know, refine the point I made. Did he have to do it? No, he didn't have to do it. And I could see people that were mad about, for him, oh, he cheap shotted the guy. Well, no, he didn't.
You know, the referee said box. He admonished the guy. He took a point away. He said box. He wasn't the one that said, okay, you have to hug before you box. And Ortiz was the one that not just hugged him, but was looking the other way. Now, did Mayweather have to do it? No. Was he within his rights to do it? Sure, why not? I mean, now, I had a time in one of my amateur fights that it was like going into the third round, and in amateur boxing, it's not, or at least collegiate boxing at the time, it was not mandatory that you touch gloves before the third round. Sometimes guys, if a guy offered it to me, I would always touch his glove as a respect. And we were fighting at the New York Athletic Center in Manhattan. Burt Sugar was there. Arthur McCanny was there. And I'm fighting a kid from Air Force, and it's dead even going into the third round. I won the first round. He won the second round. And he was taller than I was, and the bell comes out to the third round, and I put my left hand out, you know, to touch gloves. And he threw a right hand over the top. Was he, you know, was it illegal? No. Was it absolutely immoral? Yes. And
yeah,
he regretted it. He regretted it, not because that he did something wrong or got penalized. He regretted it because I punched his liver up into about his throat. but, yeah, I mean, but along the lines of officiating, I mean, would Mayweather dominated that fight and probably given a better show if he didn't knock him out with that one punch? Yeah, probably. But, I mean, he did nothing illegal.
Right.
I mean, it just hurt the sport a little bit because people I didn't watch that one live. I was actually very sick that night. I ended up going into the hospital the next day. So I was kind of following it online because I wasn't feeling well, didn't want to watch it. I was following him online, and I was like, and I'm reading the reports and reading the blog, and it's like, Ortiz just intentionally butted Mayweather in the face. You know, the referee's stepping in, he's taking a point away. Ortiz is down, and the fight's over. I said, well, he knocked himself out with a headbutt? And then I saw the replay, and I'm like, well, you know, he didn't have to do it, and it's going to kind of cement his bad guy, bad boy role. But at the same time, you know what? You're in a hurt game. You're in a fight game. If a guy's just coming out there and headbutting you in the face, God knows what else he's going to do to you. Get him out of there.
Yeah.
Take him out, you know?
I think Polly Mail and Adji said it best when a journalist went by and was complaining. Polly said, no, you know, Floyd didn't do anything wrong. When Ortiz makes it into a street fight, no one can complain when Floyd responds that way. Now, I know it upset a lot of people, and not only people who dislike Floyd. A lot of people legitimately did not like what he did. I think in the long run that is going to be good because that is going to play into the buildup of Mayweather versus Pacquiao. And I think it's going to help build more interest because Floyd does have that bad boy image. And I think in the long run, it will be a bonus for building great interest in a fight. And I realize you don't have to do too much to promote Pacquiao Mayweather, but it will be good.
Yeah, if you think about that ending, I mean, I said this right after the fact, on the next show after. That's one of those things where, you know, love him or hate him, that's the only time you're ever going to see a fight end that way. He is part of history now. So everybody's been talking about it. Everybody's going to be hyping him up because of it, you know, talking about how slick it was or how, you know, devious it was. But they're going to be talking about it. So he won out in the end, you know, either way. But interesting story here. It's changing gears a little bit. Read this week that Don King is now talking about going into MMA, which he's calling sophisticated barbarism. And his direct quote is, he says, I'm looking forward to doing MMA too and creating a competition between the UFC and whatever I call the MMA company that I put together. And he says, boxing has been self-destructing by giving fans fights, but never giving the fights they really want to see, like Mayweather versus Pacquiao. And he blames cable TV executives and promoters who, you know, are coddling their fighters. He says they know absolutely nothing about the sport. They're broadcasters. Now they've become matchmakers and managers. They're would-be promoters. But they don't put the best against the best. The only one that does out there, other than myself, is Bob Arum. And King's been out of the boxing spotlight lately, but he's just starting to make the news because he's got this new venture with Wealth TV. And they just put on a big fight between cruiserweight champion Guillermo Jones and Mike Marrone. But he doesn't have any of the big names anymore, and he's kind of being pushed out. So now he's talking about going to MMA. But
well, he makes some valid points on the boxing. I would also include some of the journalists from the Boxing Writers Association who are so dependent on the people from the networks and promoters and tend to side more with them than with the boxers or the fans. They've almost made it leagues where each promotional company has their own stable of fighters that, you know, they are very carefully promoting. And we're not seeing the best fights that could be made in boxing. Juan Ma should have fought, the big fight earlier before he got knocked out. They avoid putting the best fights together anymore.
We said that when Lopez could have fought Uriel Campbell.
Yeah. Yeah, and Arum said, well, we're going to let it marinate. Well, it's because he had a bigger investment in Juan Ma, and he knew that Gamboa would eat him up.
I'll tell you, I never like to compare guys, and I'm like, well, just because this guy beat this guy automatically means beat this guy. But I had a good friend of mine fight both of them, Roger Sotagua from Tanzania, who trained in the same gym I trained at him. And, he had Juan Ma out on the feet in the 12th round, had him out, had him beaten, and then Gamboa went in there and blew him out in 2 rounds.
Yeah. Juan Ma could have been stopped in that 12th round.
Absolutely.
Another story crossing the wires here. Floyd, before he fights Manny, he's going to have to perform 40 hours of community service because he dodged a deposition in a dispute with a guy from South Carolina. And it actually has nothing to do with boxing. It turns out this guy is being sued. Mayweather is being sued by Anthony Dash, who says a beat for a song he created in 2005 was illegally used at a pair of appearances Mayweather made at the WWE events that he participated in.
Hmm.
That's interesting because, you know, Mayweather is a Vegas native, and Pacquiao is suing him in Vegas, and the judge hasn't taken any kind of action like that here in Vegas.
Yeah.
Even though he's done the same thing. He seems like he's trying to act like he's above the law. I don't know what he's going to do when the criminal case starts happening. Starts, you know, breathing down his neck with that. But that's one of the reasons why I think this fight is going to happen in 2012.
Yeah, I agree.
On another note, happy note, we had some discussion last week about the New York Golden Gloves fighter who had the accident in the snowstorm, who was in a coma, and his sister had died. They had gotten out of the car to help some people that were in another accident, and then pileup happened, threw them off the expressway bridge. They fell 75 feet, and Pedro Luis Sosa landed first. His sister landed on top of him. She died of her, but he went into a coma, and he just woke up from his coma the other day. So
okay.
Hopefully he's going to make a good recovery there, but he has been told about his death, so at least according to this article. I don't know how well he's doing now.
Well, that's encouraging news.
Yeah, that was an unbelievable story. No good deed goes unpunished. That's what that proves.
Yeah.
I believe my sister had been on her cell phone with her mother at the time, you know, that they got knocked off the bridge.
Yeah.
Terrible tragic accident.
Mother said she was going to be all right. She dies of her injuries. Interesting story from MMA. Chris Lieben just had a big main event fight in the last UFC the other night, Saturday. Supposedly he had to cut 21 pounds in 24 hours before the fight.
Nice. That breaks my record.
Right. I don't know how he did it. And then he ended up getting knocked out, and he was like woozy after the first round. But, he said he had to cut nearly 21 pounds in 24 hours to make weight for the fight. And he was in such bad shape before the weigh-ins that the medical staff had to keep a close eye on him. He was in the hotel sauna from Friday morning, hooded up and wearing layers of clothing as he sweated out water out of his body. His dehydration and general condition was such that one of the medical team backstage said he would be pulled from the fight if things deteriorated any further.
Well, that's insane. That is how people do die.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Any promoter that allows that to happen, that they're just wrong.
And I actually kind of reminds me of a story that I got told by a guy that's no longer in the MMA business as an agent, but he used to be an agent, a guy named Ken Pavia. And he had a fighter that he was with who was cutting weight and was in real bad shape, needed help around the area. And Pavia had been sued by the UFC. So there was bad blood between him and the UFC. And they saw him in the weigh-in area before the weigh-ins were going forward, and they threw him out, you know, so this guy had nobody to help him out and, you know, keep an eye on him after such a tough weight cut. But, it's one of those things I think they need to regulate a little bit more. And there's some talk in down in Australia too about whether the sport of MMA needs tougher regulations. A guy went and suffered a stroke after straining his neck while grappling with a partner and training for MMA down there in Australia. And basically some of the doctors down there are getting upset about it. And one said, at the end of the day, no matter what the sport is, I don't think doctors are going to get much chance of changing the rules. But if we make people aware of the risks, then the governing bodies can take things into consideration.
Right.
And this doctor, Dr. Slowey, and his colleagues at Townsville Hospital, they highlighted his case in an article published by the Emergency Medicine Australasia Journal on Wednesday. And the stroke was caused by a tear to the vertebral artery, which supplies blood to the brain. And the guy arrived at the hospital in December of 2010. He was suffering from severe vertigo, nausea, and vomiting. And then after being released the next day, he returned within hours complaining of worse vertigo, headaches, and problems walking. And then the test confirmed that he had had a stroke. That's one of those topics that we discussed back when we had you on the last time, Patrick.
Mm-hmm.
The boxing versus MMA debate, which one is more dangerous? And I was kind of the mind that the jury is still out. But there had been a report showing that there were more concussions per capita for MMA than there were in boxing. And though there hasn't been too many headlines on boxing deaths lately. There was one not more than a couple months ago, I think, in Tulsa, Oklahoma. It was a church event. And it's probably shouldn't be, you know, put up there with the professional ranks, obviously, because it wasn't a professional fight. But, you know, the kid that died had never even been in a fight before. So I think that was one of the
death
factors when you're not prepared.
And people do. People do die in amateur boxing. A couple of years ago, my son Darren made it to the finals of the Golden Gloves in the Eastern Division, Albany. And he came down the week before the fight with an infected throat. And I said, you know, we're not fighting. Well, of course, I became the most unpopular dad on earth. But I told him, I've watched this sport. I remember back in 1975, Frank Berry from Syracuse fought. And they put him in over his head, heavyweight fighter, young guy, friends with my brothers and I. And, you know, he got beat up in the fight, came out, he was okay, and he died that night. And there are risks with either sport. Even under the best circumstances, there are certain risks. But people outside of the ring have to take responsibility. Like we talked about Eddie Futch, you have to step up and make those decisions so that people don't increase the risks unnecessarily, where people get hurt seriously, you know, including the ultimate dying.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that, too, because the last UFC fight, the main event there, we were just talking about the fighter in it, Chris Lieben, who had to do the weight cut. He had his eye cut open really bad. Blood was rushing right into his eyes. And the doctor, you know, took him aside and was looking at him and talking to him, and he let him, the fighter, make the decision rather than holding the fingers up saying, can you see how many fingers I'm holding up, and doing the test. He asked the fighter, you know, can you see? And, of course, the guy's not going to say no because he knows the fight's going to be over, and he's not going to go out like that. So he says, yeah, I can see. And even the announcers made a point to mention that, you know, that's not a good idea to give him the choice.
No, no.
I'll tell you one of the most scary things I ever saw, and it was at an amateur box.
Hello. All right, well, we're going to sign off. We had a little technical difficulty there. We got 90 seconds left, so adios, folks, and we'll see you next week. And we'll let Tony sign off too, so we won't be rude.
Hey, it's Tony. I should be serious now.
You hear the beep?
Do what you got to do.
You have reached maximum time allowed to make.